こんにちは。
こんにちは。
今日は特別編ということで、アストロスケールの田口雄介さんにお越しいただきました。イエイ。
ようこそ。
よろしくお願いします。
ようこそ。はじめまして。
はじめまして。
もう今まさに到着していただいて、もうすぐ始まったところなんですけども、うん、田口さんはもともとは JAXA で働いてらっしゃったんでしたっけ？
は
い。
前職は、まあ、厳密に言うと有人宇宙システム、うん、ジャムスっていう会社の社員で、筑波宇宙センターで、宇宙飛行士とか地上の管制官の方々 の訓練のインストラクターとして働いておりました。
すごい、うん、宇宙飛行士のインストラクターってな何をするんですか？
はい。まず地上400キロの高さに国際宇宙ステーション ISS っていうのがありますけど、うん、そちらは、まあ、主にアメリカとロシアですけど、それ以外に、カナダがロボットアームを作ってますし、日本が、希望っていう実験棟、うん、あとヨーロッパ のコロンブスっていう実験棟もあるんですけど、日本に来られる宇宙飛行士の方には我々がその希望の使い方ですね、
うん、
で、まあ、彼らとして一番重要なのはやっぱり生きて帰ってくることですから、
うん、
主に、緊急事態とか、起こったりとか、機器が故障したりしたときにどうやって対処するかっていうことを、宇宙飛行士の方に教えております。
すごい。その緊急事態っていうのは例えばどういうことを想定してるんですか？
はい。一番彼らにとって、緊急度が高いっていうのは、うん、3つあって、
うん、
火災と、うん、急減圧、まあ、具体的に言うと例えば壁に穴が開いて急に空気が抜けてしまった時とかですね。あともう一つは空気の汚染なんですけど、まあ通常はそういった、空気が汚染されるような、物質は使わないようにしてるんですけど、宇宙ステーションの外側ですね、夜だとマイナス100度ぐらい、昼間だとプラス100度ぐらいまで行くので、やっぱ冷えてるときは まだいいこともあるんですけど、暑くなりすぎると熱で物は壊れるとかそういったことが起こりかねないので、特に宇宙ステーションの中身っていうのはほとんどもう機械で動いてますから、それによる熱っていうのはすごいんですよね。それを逃がすためにアンモニアを一部使ってるんですね。アンモニアって、まあ、皆さん身近なところでしたら尿とかにもちろん入ってますけど、あれアンモニアそのものっていうのは実は結構劇薬で強い毒なんですけど、例えばアンモニアの匂いがするっていうぐらい発生してたらもう相当やばいです。
あ、そうなんだ。
はい。ですからそのアンモニアが万が一その大気中宇宙ステーションの中の、空気の中に漏れてきたら、それに対してどう対処するか、その3つ、火災、急減圧と大気汚染が主なその緊急事態ですね。
I always think of I mean, when you're saying this, I think of like Apollo 13 and kind of the not only the mental fortitude that you need to remain calm in that kind of situation where, you know, if you're one of the astronauts in the vehicle, you don't know if there's a solution. You could be, your fate could be sealed, you know, right then. How do you feel about the psychological aspect of this? Do you think about that?
Well, that's one of the worst things that could actually happen is the astronauts panic.
Right.
They don't have no idea what to do. And, you know, I'm sure you've experienced it yourselves, but once you get into that situation, you can't think straight.
Mm. Yeah.
And even if someone gives you the correct advice, you can't hear them.
Mm.
So that's in order to avoid such a situation, that's why we train the astronauts for almost everything that we can think of.
Mm-hmm.
So even if anything out of the unusual happens, they'll be at least to somewhat extent mentally prepared.
Mm-hmm.
So they can work upon these situations in a calm manner.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the people on the ground always think of the worst situations that could ever happen. And we provide training to the astronauts so they can be prepared to react to these situations. Mm-hmm. So anything other than that would be rather very unusual to happen, especially if it's life-threatening.
Yeah. Yes. We often joke about the character Steve Buscemi, who is known for...
Armageddon, have you seen that? Of
course.
Steve Buscemi が あの現地でちょっとおかしくなっちゃって銃みたいなのを乱射するみたいなシーンがあってそれがこう私の中ではすごい記憶に残っていて、まあ、宇宙の環境に置かれた時に急にこうパニックになっておかしくなるっていうことを、まあ、リファレンスとして常にスティーブ・ジェミを例に出してるんですけどなんかそういう状態を防ぐためにっていうことですよね。
そういうことです、はい、だから本当に、まあ、あの映画の場合は結構あの急遽集めた方々でしたから、
ね、
多分その訓練という意味では十分ではなかったと思うんですけど
そもそも宇宙飛行士じゃないですもんね、
まあそうです
ね is it more like the, have you, you've seen the movie The Right Stuff? Have you seen that one?
I think
it's,
I have
It's kind of an old movie
Yes
but,
it is
It's about they're trying toassemble an astronaut crew and it's about the selection process and the training and you know they're not the right stuff is like we need to find people who have the right stuff you know we need to find so they're looking at all these different people and trying to figure out you know is this person suitable for this space mission or not you know and there's physiological considerations and psychological considerations and disease history and like all kinds of crazy stuff that,It's fascinating to me that this process of like selecting the, you know, the best people is revolves around the space endeavor, you know.
Well, you brought up a very interesting point because the best people that an agency is looking for, it depends on the kind of people they're looking for at that exact moment.
For that task.
Yes.
So the qualifications change
exactly.
a lot.
Because, for example, the first seven that were selected, I think they were all from military.
Fighter pilots.
Yes, fighter pilots. Because, well, physically they're tough. And many of them, I believe, were Air Force or Marines.
Yeah.
Because they had experience in flying airplanes in extreme situations.And I've experienced a bit myself, but trying to fly a plane, you have to react instantly to something that happens because it's life-threatening. I mean, if you have like an engine failure, you have to know what to do immediately or you can risk yourself just falling into on the ground or killing yourself. So that's what, those are many of the important traits that were... that NASA was looking for.
Like responsibility too. Like a fighter pilot is, you know, it's a lot of responsibility.
Exactly.
You're flying around in this, costs like $350 million.
Exactly. Yeah. It's not cheap.
You're like doing tricks and stuff you don't need to be doing. It's like,
and another thing is that they follow orders. They're used to following orders.
So right. Compliance.
Yes. So they won't judge your decisions on an action you were asked to do. They'll just do it.
Yeah.
Yes. And that's something that's not always perfect, but it's respected and expected from the astronauts. Yes. Because the people on the ground, 24 hours, 7 days a week, they're always thinking about how to bring the astronauts safely back home, even if a very trivial problem occurs. So with all that information that the astronauts don't have on board, the people on the ground would expect the astronauts to do as they were told.
It's a reasonable expectation, right? Hey, we're not putting you on the spaceship unless you follow our instructions.
Exactly.
Like, just sign right here.
They can't be rebellious or something.
No. Nope. Yeah, we can't risk that happening on board. If that happens once... You'll never know which direction things will be going.
そのトレーニング自体はどう、なんかその実技みたいなこともあるんですか？
もちろん、特にその緊急事態の対応に関しては、もうマニュアルがもう決まってますので、例えばこの、この機械で火災が起きたら、まずここで本当に火災か、それともただ、 機器の異常で温度が上がってるのかとか、そういうこう調べ方っていうか、もうすべてあの手順書っていうあのマニュアルがございまして、それを見たらもう全部書いてあるんですね。ですからそれを特にその緊急事態の3つ、その火災と急減圧と大気汚染ですね、その3つに対してはもうマニュアルを見なくても大体覚えてるように、何回も繰り返してやったりしますね。
なるほど。
How has the machine controls and kind of automation changed the responsibilities of these astronauts going into space? Because I have to imagine in the early days it was must have been a lot of button pushing and manual flipping. You know,
that's a very interesting question, because for almost every anomaly that occurs on the space station, there's something called an automated procedure that occurs to react to that anomaly. So there's a program prepared to act upon these anomalies. And so in order to do that, they have sensors that check, you know, the temperature, the air quality, the currents, everything on board for every, almost every electronical equipment. So for the majority of the times when an anomaly occurs, the astronauts don't have to do anything. They don't even know it occurred, because this automated procedure will run by itself to cover up for that problem. Or, of course, the people, the flight controllers on the ground will take care of it.
Yeah. Do you see AI picking up from there in the near future and kind of getting to the high now, the HAL 9000 artificial intelligence kind of managing the ship?
Well, I would say AI is already available on the ISS already, because just like I explained right now, these automated procedures, they occur according to the kind of telemetry that they get from these sensors and all. So yeah, I guess you could say that they're like a sort of AI.
So the main differences between something like that and the functionality of HAL 9000 would be HAL 9000 is constantly communicating with the astronauts and updating them on things, and they're kind of working together, I guess. That's not really happening right now, right? Because it's more the AI and the ground control, and then the ground control to the astronauts, right?
Exactly, yes. So there's no, you know, bilateral communication on the ISS from the machine to the astronauts, opposed to HAL 9000. I mean,
but maybe that could be different in a corporate environment in the future, though, right? Do you think there's always going to be ground control for spacecraft? Or is it possible that we get to a point where we have spacecraft that don't, you know, they check in with a, you know, ground control, but they're not necessarily operated from a ground control?
Okay, well let me ask you this then. Say you're on a spacecraft headed far away to like Mars or Jupiter even. And basically everything is controlled by the AI that's on board the spacecraft itself. And say something happens to the AI itself. Some, I don't know, maybe a solar flare, or I don't know, maybe a small asteroid hits the main computer.
Yeah.
And you lose control of the spacecraft because you lost the AI itself. Now what do you do?
Say goodbye.
Well, that's not an option. Well, failure is not an option, as they say.
Let's say an asteroid hits Earth and and now Earth is obliterated. Okay. It's a good thing we have this dependable AI here.
Exactly.
Yeah, I see.
We do, you know, because computers, they can think faster than we do for certain tasks. We would like to rely on them to do these tasks and even make some decisions to a certain level. But if something happens that the AI itself never expected, you can't expect the AI to react to that so that you're safe.
Yeah.
because you can't expect, you don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
So that's why we always have to have the astronauts be prepared for a serious incident that may threaten their lives. Mm. Because in the end, do you really want to rely on a machine?
Yeah.
Maybe yeah. certain things, definitely, yes.
But it's also, I have to imagine that hearing a human voice from Earth has to be pretty comforting too, you know,
oh, definitely,
if you're in
yes.
outer space. Like,
yes.
It's like, it must feel amazing to hear, you know, people on Earth.
Yeah.
How do you even know what's going on down there? Like, you know, if the radio transmission just cut off, I mean, there could be, anything could be going on Earth, right? I mean, are there protocols for interruption of services on Earth? Or I mean, is that a way too far out question? Like, if
like
there
some,
was
somehow
a,
Houston cannot
so
respond.
Like, on Earth, there's a war,
huge
for example,
earthquake
between.
Or something.
Mm. Well, there's a war, for example, between mm-hmm. the United States and Russia or China or something. What happens to these cooperating astronauts on the International Space Station, which presumably have nothing to do with the conflict other than their nationalities, but so much of this of space industry and exploration, it seems, has relied on this international cooperation. Sometimes when I see political tensions and whatnot happening, I worry about our space enterprise.
Well, that's you raised a good point, because that's what I really liked about the working in space is mm-hmm. because, yes, you know, in the Cold War, they were beating up against each other. Mm-hmm. And look at now. They're on the same ship together.
Mm-hmm.
And even the NASA astronauts, they're launching from the Soyuz. Mm-hmm. It's a Russian rocket. Yes, you know, we all have our differences, and especially when politics gets involved, it gets mm-hmm. a bit messy. But all of a sudden, when we're talking about working together in space, all that's put aside.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone's working for a common goal mm. is to bring back the benefits of space down to Earth for mm. a better tomorrow.
Mm.
And I just really like this this concept, because actually I've experienced something very similar when I first moved to the States. When I moved over to the States, I was just 4 years old, and I never really received any like serious education in Japan.
Mm.
And I remember when I started going to elementary school, and I was first in New York, then moved over to New Jersey. So there are lots of many foreign people in the area, especially mm-hmm. Japanese people at that time. Mm-hmm. But there were also Chinese people from China, Singapore, Korea, many Asian people. And, you know, when you first meet, you know, we look pretty similar compared to the, you know, American people, European people, of course. Yeah. So I would think that it's easier to get along.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the first time we talk, they hate my guts.
Yeah.
And I had no idea why they hate me. But in the end, you know, we end up being friends because it's so much easier.
Mm.
You know, we look alike. I mean, there's some sort of similar culture between our different countries. And when I came back to Japan, I really started learning the history of Japan. And that's when I really understood, oh, sure, they hate my guts. I would perfectly understand
yeah.
because of, you know, what Japan has done in the past. But, like, I ended up with my friends. You know, in the end, we became friends because it doesn't matter the history yeah. or the politics. Yeah. It's, in the end, it comes down to just a person-to-person relationships.
The enterprise of space really captivates that because it transcends, you know, our national boundaries and our roots. It transcends the entire planet. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's in that sense, I think it's really like aspirational. It's like we could do amazing things with these other countries on the highest level, the most, you know, the most advanced level, technologically and in terms of, you know, sensitive information and all of these very difficult obstacles to make these international space projects happen, you know, they do happen. And And we do benefit like tremendously from mm-hmm. it. So, yeah, I absolutely agree that space is kind of symbolic that way for a lot of human beings that feel like we could come together
yeah.
in a different way.
Mm-hmm. それがそのままであってほしいなと思いますよね。こうなんか火星に例えばコロニー作るとか月にベース作るとか実際にこう土地って話になった時に、まあ、先週まさにトランプ大統領がその、まあ、戦争紛争地域の、はい、What did he exactly say? I forget. But, まあ、としての宇宙みたいな話してましたけど、
はい、いや本当にそうなんですよね。まあ、もちろん、ぶっちゃけお金の問題もありますけど、うん、やっぱりそのどんどん遠くへ行こうと思ってくると一国で賄えるような金額ではないですし、
うん、
まあ、技術的にもそうですし、やっぱりそれともう一つは宇宙に行くともう日本代表とかアメリカ代表じゃなくて地球代表になるんですよね、
うん、
そう思うと自分の国がどうとかっていう話はなかなか、もしその宇宙人に会った場合ですねそんな話できないですよね。
どうでもいいですもんね、はい、あっちからすると
この地球のこの日本っていう国っていうのはよりは太陽から3つ目の石ころから来てますよ。ソルブンロックフォンのムーン、あ、サン、サン。だからまあ私自身がその宇宙の勉強をしてて、そういうちょっとものの考え方の変化があったなっていうのが。まあ、一番嬉しかったなと思うことの一つですね。
うん、なんかその今一瞬宇宙人っておっしゃられてましたけど、なんか前に何回かこう宇宙の話もマイケルとしていて、その、まあ、クライシストレーニングを受けて宇宙飛行士宇宙に行くわけですけども、その中でこう、まあ、変な話宇宙人みたいなものとかこう地球外生命体に出会っちゃった時にどうしたらいいかみたいなことってマニュアルに入ってたりするんですか？それとも
我々が訓練している範囲ではないですね。
あ、そうなんだ。
ただもしかしたらそういう訓練も受けているかもしれません。絶対ないとは言い切れないので、まあ、ただ私学生の時はずっと天文学を専攻してたんですけど、一応その天文学の世界の中ではもし見つかっても絶対すぐには公表しない。
はい、
でまずその天文学会の中でその宇宙人関係の担当の人たちに相談するとそれで世界で共同で確認する、そこでもう間違いないって確証を得たら初めて公表されたりする。
I don't know if we have, do we have time to do all that stuff? It's probably like immediately.
Well,
the aliens are here, run.
Under the assumption that we just find a signal first.
Yeah.
Not that we see a UFO right away.
Yeah, it doesn't warp above yeah, exactly. the White House or something. Just right there.
Or just zaps us off the map or anything like that.
How did you get interested in space? Initially,
well, to begin with, when I was born in 76 in Japan, and when I was three, that's when Gundam started, and it's also when Star Wars Episode 4 was released, and it was like pretty natural for boys my age to get interested in space, and I just vaguely thought, cool, space, very cool, I want to be there one day.
But how did you get past the... Because a lot of people get interested in space, but they don't go as deep as you are.
Yes, I think almost everyone in the world grow up and at some point they get interested in space.
Yeah, it's like a phase for most people.
Uh-huh. And like I mentioned before, when I was four, I moved over to the States, and that was 1980. And the 80s were the golden age of the space shuttle. So naturally, you know, when you watch the news, it's about space, people going to space on the space shuttle. And yes, I remember in 1986 when the Challenger incident occurred. I just got home from end of the term test or something. So I was home at before lunch, and I turned the TV, and every channel was this explosion happened.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I wasn't it was still something that's above the clouds, becoming an astronaut. But I always wanted to be one. Mm. And I remember when I was, I think I was 12, my friend, my Japanese friend, his father worked for a publishing company in Japan, Shogakukan. Mm. Yes, and they wanted to do a special tour of the space facilities in the U.S. Mm. And my friend was offered to follow along with that tour. And he was told that he could bring a friend along with him.
Ooh.
And he chose me. That was very awesome. But yeah, it was my first time to visit, Washington, D.C., the Smithsonian Museum. I also got a chance to meet astronaut John Glenn.
Oh.
Yes. Wow.
And after that, we went headed to Florida to see the Kennedy Space Center, where the shuttles were launched. And also went to Johnson Space Center in Houston.
Wow, this tour is sugoi.
It was very awesome. And of course, I have a good memorabilia of all that. But I don't show it to anyone because I was looking ugliest of my life when I had that time. I had a terrible haircut. And I was so chubby and ugly. I think I only show this to my wife.
Well, they have Photoshop now. You can...
Change your hairstyle.
Face swap.
I'll change it with, Leonardo DiCaprio or someone like that.
別人. Yeah.
And yeah, that was a real big trigger that I wanted to get really involved in space someday.
Mm.
And I kept that dream even up to entering university. Mm. And I remember when I was in, I was already back in Japan, and I was thinking about what to major in university.
Mm.
And I had all these wild ideas, like making Gundam myself, you know. But I wanted to do something that was related to space. And at that time, it was just after the Hubble Space Telescope was launched. Mm. And the first results were coming down to the ground. And there was a little nonfiction book that was published that I read. And I saw all these beautiful images of space. But I had no idea what I was looking at. Mm. I couldn't understand anything. I could feel that it was beautiful. But I couldn't understand what it was. So I thought, I would like to know what I'm looking at.
Mm.
And that's where I got interested in astronomy.
Oh.
And I was luckily able to major in astronomy in the university, and I got my PhD.
Wow.
So it's like the intrinsic aesthetics or the intrinsic beauty of these celestial objects kind of hooked you in, right? I think it's so weird how objects in space are so beautiful and might be some of the most beautiful things that we've ever found.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of these pinwheel galaxies and stuff, yeah. It's just mind-boggling how beautiful they are. And you look at pictures of the inside of your own body or something, it's disgusting. You know, like, there's a lot of things that there's no clear reason to me why it should be that pleasing to look at, but you know, you go to Mauna Kea or something and you look at the Milky Way, it's just mind-blowing.
Oh, you've been there?
I've been up there many times.
Beautiful, yes. I've been there myself, and everything I saw while I was there, it's just amazing. It's,
yeah.
You know, it's these times when I wish I was an artist. I could really express what I'm feeling, but I don't have the words or the technology or anything to
we'll trust that it's going on.
Yeah.
Do you still have that dream of becoming an astronaut or going to space?
Yes, I do. Because, and I remember all throughout my life, I vaguely wanted to become an astronaut. I always wanted to become an astronaut, but it was not something realistic. It was just a dream, you know, something above the clouds. I remember when I was in my first year of my PhD, I was selected to participate in a conference that was held in Houston. It was hosted by JAXA.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And all 15 of us were selected to join this conference. And it was in Houston, so where the astronauts train most of their time. So, on the last night we were there, we were very lucky to have Mr. Soichi Noguchi. Mm. He joined us, and it was my first, you know, close encounter with a real astronaut. And it was so weird because when I was talking to him, I thought, you know, this guy is just another human being.
普通の人じゃんみたいな。
そう、本当に。なんか今までなんかもう本当に雲の上の存在の人だ、なんかだと思ってた人が喋ってみたら変な話を、あれ同じ人間じゃんみたいな。それでそのなるためにまずその条件があるんですよ、応募するために。私はその時ドクターの1年だったんですけど、このまま順調に博士号を取ることができたら応募できる、もう満たしているので、うん、あれ意外といけるやんと、うん、思ってですね、そこで初めて具体的な目標になりました。
現実的な、
そうですね、あ、なれる可能性が本当にあるんだっていう、
実際どういうプロセスで皆さん宇宙飛行士になるものなんですか。
現在の、宇宙に行く人っていうのはやはり主に科学実験をすることが目的なので、
そかそかそか、
はい、やっぱりそういうこともあって理系の大学で理系を専攻してて卒業してるっていう条件はありますね。あとは実務経験も3年積んでいること、大学卒業後にですね。
実務経験っていうのは、社会人経験っていう意味ですか、それとも、
ただ何でもいいっていうわけではなくて、そういう研究開発関連の、実務経験3年ですね。あと、そういう科学者みたいなバックグラウンドがなければパイロットで、何時間以上の、フライト経験がある。そういう主にそういう2つがあって、あと共通しているところが、例えば、健康であることとか、あとプールで、確か10分間ぐらいだったかな、立ち泳ぎができるとか、それは海の上とかに不時着した場合に、レスキューが来るまでに自分の命を守るっていうための条件なんですね。決してそういう体力を持ってるとか、そういう、もちろん体力もそうなんですけど、はい、そういうわけではないです。
It'd be so lame if you went to space and then you land and then you can't swim. You went all the way to space and did all this crazy stuff.
ギリギリのところでダメみたいな。
Yeah, we should have got someone who can tread water. Do you think that you're going to space? That you will go to space?
Whether I'm selected as a JAXA astronaut or not, that would really depend on the kind of person they're looking for at that time. Because, yes, I might not fit perfectly in that, what they're looking for. But I'm pretty positive that I'll get my chance to go to space in one way or another before I die, provided I have enough money to.
I guess it will cost, it'll still be quite expensive during our lifetimes, most likely, right?
Yes, I would think at least my lifetime maybe, but I'm sure that by my time before my son passes away, he'll experience the time where it's just another big vacation.
What do you think of the time frame for these things? When do you think we'll have space hotels and Mars base, or when it's not just JAXA and NASA and these other organizations, but actually you can fly up on a private rocket and do so recreationally, or you could get paid to, it seems like there's going to be a lot of jobs in space, or at least at the Mars stage. There would be a lot of employment as well. I mean, what do you think of that time frame? Is it relevant to people? Because a lot of people listening to this could be, 15 or 20 years old. What is it going to look like in 20, 40 years?
Well, just like the shirt you're wearing, company SpaceX, I'm sure, I think Elon Musk said that he would send people to Mars before 2030.
2025,
yeah,
and even start building bases and things there. But the relevance of that is, that's a very good question, because do we really need to expand ourselves beyond the planet? I mean, this planet Earth. Well, would you like to ask the same question to Columbus?
Yeah.
I mean, did he really have to risk all the lives of his crewmates to find a land that he doesn't even know exists? So, you know, there's a part of us inside that always wants to go out and discover new things. And even if that's not enough for that to spend money on, you know, we have a growing population that maybe one day it won't be sustainable just on our little planet here. And can you force people not to have children? Maybe some countries can do that, but I don't know if it's really realistic to do that on a planet-wide thing.
So you think the time frame for these things arriving is, it's well within most young people's lifetime?
Oh, definitely, I would say
so. The Mars base even?
Yes.
So if you're in high school right now, consider the Mars base in the distant future.
I mean, before they retire, I'm sure they can be a part of building that Mars base, or even being there themselves.
There's a lot of people that don't believe this stuff is going to happen. You know, there's a lot of, I mean, people like myself. I mean, the clothing gives it away, but and you, we're quite optimistic. I think you know, this is going to happen. We're going to space. There will be a Mars base built, but I think the possibility of this actually happening hasn't sunk into the heads of a lot of people. Like, we are almost really basically there in terms of the technological hurdles, right? We're almost there. Like, we could pull it off probably tomorrow, but it would be really ugly, right? And a lot more expensive. But within like 10, 15, 20 years, it seems like the technology is, and the demand will just usher in this whole space age. Do you think it's like you said when you were growing up, the golden age with the space shuttle? Do you think we're kind of moving into a new golden age now?
Oh, definitely, yes. Especially now that there are more private companies working in the space. You know, it's not just the big agencies run by the countries that are in space anymore. It's more, you know, people are making money out of it and trying to make, run commerce on it. So, and as long as there's someone who wants to see something new, discover something new, reach out to the universe, I'm sure there's definitely someone going to be up there.
Yeah. I want to go.
To Mars?
Yeah, I'm planning to go to Mars eventually.
Yeah, me too.
if you had the chance to go to Mars and you didn't take it, I mean, for me, that just doesn't quite sit right, you know? Like, why didn't I go to Mars? You know, I'd just be lying, you know, in bed, like, old or something. Like, why didn't I go to Mars when I could have gone to Mars?
Would you do that really? If it was just a one-way trip?
Yeah, that would be my question, exactly. Because that's what Elon said at the beginning, like, you won't be able to come back.
I thought he said you can come back. I think Elon is quite adamant that the rocket ship is coming back eventually. But the initial trips would not be able to return until they established the fuel depot with the Sabatier process.
Yeah, you're going to be stuck there.
But you have stuff to do. It's just a long mission, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you can go back
eventually. I guess it depends on who you're going to be with on Mars. Right?
That's definitely important. Yeah. I'm sure.
Right?
Because you won't go there alone to begin with.
Yeah.
I think you'll go crazy before you reach Mars if you're alone. Mm.
Yeah.
They did a isolation experiment with a team of supposedly qualified people to be astronauts, and they did an experiment in some desert somewhere where they had these people live in a simulated Martian habitat, a dome. And they found that they really got on each other's nerves after a while, and they were irritating each other.
Yeah.
And the result of that study was that one of the major concerns for these long-term missions is people getting along with each other.
絶対それ大事だよね。だって火星行っちゃったらもう同じ人と毎日会わ、まあ、宇宙ステーションもそうですよね。
そうです、はい、
同じ人とずっともう閉じ込められてるわけだから。
そうなんですよ、うん、ですから宇宙ステーションに行く、飛行士を選ぶときもですね、やっぱり相性も、
う
ん、まあ、多少はないとも考慮されています。
ああ、
はい、
そうなんです。
ただもちろん誰と一緒になっても大丈夫なように選ばれてたり訓練されてるはずなんですよ ね、 、はい、
ね、喧嘩とかに なってる場合じゃないですもんね。
大変ですよ、もう喧嘩になっちゃったら。、はい、
Do you think the psychology, the psychological aspect differs?、If you're in the space station, the Earth is right there. It's very close.
Mm-hmm.
And astronauts often say, you know, they have this overview effect. And mm-hmm. just looking at the Earth is incredibly pleasurable. But once you're all the way on Mars, it's so much further away. The Earth becomes this dot again, you know. It's so far.
Yeah, and
it's weird to think about how far away it is. Like,
and even to make things worse, even if you call to Earth,
yeah,
you won't get a reply about for like 20 minutes.
Right.
Mm. Yeah.
So the relativity of space is a real factor for how lonely you begin to feel, mm-hmm. you know.
でも逆に考えると20分待てば返事が来るっていうのもそれはそれですごいですよね。
いや、でも実際それをやってみると多分相当ストレスがあると思います。
イライラする、
はい、It's not a conversation, you know, it doesn't feel.
いや、確かに。
It's like when we, you know, when you'd make a phone call to your relatives on like Brastel or something like a way back beforeThe you know IP phones and all this mm-hmm. Skyping stuff, there would be that delay, and you're trying to talk to you know your aunt or something on the phone, but the it's just a second or 2 second delay is enough to just make it so much harder to talk,
yeah.
you know, and you feel far away just because of that little delay.
Yeah.
But now you call up your relative in a different country, and the FaceTime's on, and it's crisp,
mm-hmm.
and you don't feel.Like you're that far away anymore. It's like we can interact, right? So it's like that clunkiness. Once you're on Mars, there's no way around that. You know, right?
No,
it's physics.
Uh-huh.
Forever. It doesn't exactly. matter how good your technology gets. The Skype will always suck when you're calling Earth.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So it's more of a psychological problem about going further and further. Mm. If the person.That's actually going there can really withstand this stress.
Because it's beyond the limits of our technology, you know. Because
mm-hmm.
right now, I think the International Space Station can FaceTime Earth, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, they can call in and it's like, how's it going?
Yeah, of course, and there is a, like, maybe a second or so delay in the communication, but it's, you know, it's reasonable.
Mm.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, that's interesting to think about, you know. Once you have a Mars civilization, you know, with its own government and its own society and presumably its own culture, how do we maintain the, you know, hey, we're all still human. Remember that, guys. Like, don't become a different species and start your own.
Don't forget us.
Your own empire or something.
Yeah.
ね、だからそのうち火星で生まれる子がいて、地球には行ったことない人間ができてみたいな、
まあ、そういう日も来るでしょうね。
ね、
ね、そのガンダムとかあと、まあ、弊社がやってるこの宇宙ゴミの掃除も、あのプラネテスっていうアニメと漫画が あるんですけど、そちらでもその月面で生まれて月面でずっと育った人間っていうのは登場したんですけど、まあ、そこはなかなかうまく描写できてたなと思ったんですけど、そのすごい背が高いっていうのはまず、やっぱり重力に引っ張られてないから、その自由にその伸び、まあ、重力はゼロじゃないですけど、地球ほどないので、なんか伸びやすいとか、あとやっぱりね、我々は地球人として生まれてるので、多分そういったところで生まれたり育ったりするとうまくいかないんですよね、多分その内臓とか。
そっか、
だからそういう人は仮にその初めて地球に来たって言ったら大変だと思いますね。
あ、そっか。
はい。
Do they know for sure that I guess it's we're fairly certain that if you had a child on Mars that that child would not develop properly because of the gravitational differences and
I don't know if
is it just an impossibility for anyone to ever have children on Mars because of the gravitational issues?
To deliver a child on Mars, I think it's possible.
Right.
But whether that person would grow up
healthy.
Normally or healthy yeah. would be something that needs to be looked into very deeply before it ever happens.
だからその、まあ、一人だとあれですけど、こう規模が大きくなって何百人とか生まれて、どれその中で生き残った子がいてっていうふうにどんどんこう進ある意味火星で進化していくと、あ、火星ではこういう人が生き残れるんだっていう、なんか別地球とはまた別のトレイトになる可能性ありますよね。
まあ別の生物になるかもしれないですね。まあ遺伝子は違うでしょうね。
うん、
はい。まあただそこまでその実験っていうかそれ繰り返すかって言ったらまあ相当倫理的な問題があると思うんで簡単ではないですね。
すごい時間かかるし、
はい、時間はすごいかかりますね。
There was a study recently about the astronaut that returned from the space station, and there was a lot of articles saying that 7% of their DNA had changed.
Yes,
That wasn't technically correct, but and NASA apologized for that. But the actual changes were not the genes, but epigenetic changes, so genetic expression. We know now that there are significant epigenetic effects to being in space, even for a moderate amount of time. So I guess there is, the verdict is not in yet on what the long-term effects are of
exactly,
you know, being in space a lot. But most of the astronauts seem fine, right?
Well,
like there's no incidence of like space killing someone.
Oh,
yet,
no,
right?
No.
Like that hasn't happened, right?
Well, that's why they have to go through a very strict selection. You know, we can't risk having people killing each other on the space station.
Oh, but like killed or by like radiation.
Oh, yes. If you are already exposed to some amount of radiation, they won't let you go to space.
Oh, really?
You know, because, you know, you can't risk someone getting diseased while they're on the space station. Yeah.
I was just about to abandon my career as a nuclear plant operator and go to space. And they're like, no, we can't take you.
Mm-hmm.
I want to hear more about this orbital debris project. What's the plan?
Well, to begin with, you know, how many people out there aware about space debris, or if there's any problem to begin with?
You know, that's like the exact sentence that I started my project with in probably like 2007. I gave a presentation at my university for my environmental sciences class.
Seriously?
Specifically about orbital debris.
Really?
Yeah, and everyone's like, what is this kid talking about? Nobody knew. The teacher had no idea. She had to Google and make sure it was real.
Uh-huh.
It was...
you already had Google.
Yeah,
because, you know, when we start, one of the big hurdles of our company is to have people aware of this issue. To begin with, I mean, space sweepers. What? What are you sweeping up in space? Is there anything to sweep to begin with? I mean, yeah. But, you know, starting with Sputnik in 1957, until that, there was nothing artificial out there. Yeah. There might have been, you know, dust from comets and things, but nothing artificial. But ever since Sputnik was launched, the space race began. And, of course, it was still in the Cold War, so it was everything between U.S. and Russia.
Yeah.
And they were, you know, they couldn't risk losing against each other.
Minimal environmental concern.
Exactly. Of course. So all these satellites, these artificial robots, have been launched into space, but not really concerned about what would happen after they finish their job.
Mm.
But in the 70s, a professor called, I forgot his first name, but Dr. Kessler from NASA, he said that at the pace we're sending all these things, artificial things in space, we'll get to a point where they will collide into each other.
Mm.
And once that happens, you'll just have tons of more garbage and more smaller size in space. And if there's enough of this junk, it'll just keep on colliding with more junk, making more and more junk, and making space so polluted that we won't be able to send anything up there anymore.
Mm.
Because this moment we do, it'll just get destroyed.
Right.
It was called the Kessler syndrome.
Mm.
Yeah, yes. That was part of my presentation.
それまではもうそのことについて特にその議論されてなかったんですかね。
まあ議論はされていましたけど、まあ本当に弊社のその岡田がその会社を作るまでも、そういう問題があるよね、そうだねみたいな感じで皆さんその話はしてた、議論はしてたんですけど、誰もその具体的な行動を起こそうっていう人はそのエージェンシーでもなかったんですね。それで岡田が、あ、誰もやってないんだったら俺がやろうって、なんかブルーオーシャンを見つけちゃったよっていうことでアストロスケールが創立されたんです
ね。それはその問題が大きすぎてもうなんかどうしたらいいかわからないからこう手をつけにくいっていうことだったんですかね。
まあそれもありますけど、もう一つがやはりそれまでその宇宙にあるゴミを打ち上げたっていうのは全部国なんですよね。
うん。
でまあ今でも9割はロシア、アメリカ、中国なんですけど、まあその国が責任取って除去したらいいやんっていう誰もが思うんですけど、ただその打ち上げた側の論理としては、確かに打ち上げたのは我々だけど、それの利益を受益者っていうんですけど、その例えば GPS にしても、それの技術的な良さを享受しているのは皆さんですよねと。じゃあみんなちょっと責任取っていいんじゃないのみたいな。はい。まあ、そういういろんな、まあ、双方の議論があってですね、なかなかそのルールで絶対こうしなさいっていうのはできないです、できない状況なんですね。ただ国連には宇宙の平和利用っていうそういう分科会があってですね、そこではそのガイドラインあるんですね、こうみんなこうしようねと。ただそれに対する罰則っていうのは一切ないので、結局まあそうできたらいいねぐらいなものしかないんですよね。
How urgent do you think this issue is, and how prone is it to getting worse if we don't address it?
Well, you know, everyone's been saying that a satellite and satellite will collide each other someday.
Mm.
But unfortunately, in 2009, it happened.
Mm.
A U.S. operating Iridium satellite collided with a Russian spy satellite.
Mm.
And that collision, of course, caused a chain reaction of all these garbage. And all of a sudden, we have a few thousand more pieces of junk into space.
And how fast are these satellites moving?
Well, in order to launch a satellite into space, it has to reach about 8 kilometers per second.
Whoa.
Yes. Or it'll never get there in the first place.
So potentially there's a combined velocity of 16 kilometers a second, two satellites.
If they go head-to-head, that is.
Yeah.
Yes. But at least they'll have 8 kilometers per second. And that's, if you calculate it to hours, it's 28,000 kilometers per hour, which is about 100 times faster than the bullet train, 10 times faster than a bullet.
So the ability of that kind of impact to just make fragments, and then the lack of gravity and the lack of any sort of medium to slow those fragments down, it's just like a perfect recipe for making debris that flies everywhere.
Yes. Right? Well, about the slowing down point, up to about 550 kilometers from the surface, there's actually some effect from the Earth's atmosphere.
Mm.
Yeah, so it does. The residue of the atmosphere does cause some drag force,
like percolating air polyp
exactly,
particles.
Yeah. So anything that's up to 550 kilos from the surface does experience this drag force. Mm. So eventually, they do come back to the atmosphere and burn up.
Mm-hmm. Is your focus then going to be objects that are just beyond that threshold?
Exactly, yes. More so on those above that threshold.
So like the 700 kilometer, or what altitude are we?
Well, realistically, we'll first focus on things that are relatively closer, that it's more reachable. Yes, because the further they are, it takes more thrust, more money to reach them. So basically, things around 600 or less than 2,000 kilos.
Huh.
Yes.
具体的にそのスイーピングはどうやって行う予定なんでしょうか。
はい。まあ宇宙ゴミといってもね、あのミリサイズのものから例えばあのロケットの打ち上げた時にですね、あの衛星とかが入ってる先っちょのフェアリングっていうんですけど、あのカバーですね、あれも実は残ってるんですね宇宙に、はい、そういうものになってくると本当にあの数トンあの本当にバスぐらいの大きさになってくるのでもうピンキリです、ただ、現在の、技術ではあの10センチ角より大きいものしかあの地上からは観測できないんですね。
あ、
だそれより小さいものはもう確実にあるんですけど、わからないんですね、どこにどれだけあるかっていうのは。でそういうわからないものに対してはさすがにそれを一個ずつ取りに行くっていうのは効率悪いですし、あまり現実じゃないので、そういうものに対しては結局あの防御するしかないんですよね。
あ、なるほど。
はい、ですからあの、ね、宇宙飛行士もあの船外活動やる宇宙服 もう何層もそういう防御があるので、動きにくいっていうのがあるんですね。でそれより大きいものは一応見えるので、まあ、あのアストロスケールとしてまずやろうとしているのは、これから新しく打ち上がる衛星に、弊社がその後から打ち上げる衛星で捕まえに行けるように、その目安とできるそういうあのマーカーみたいなものをつけてもらって、それをめがけて後からあのその衛星が例えばあの機能不全になったり運用が終了したって、ただ漂うだけで終わらないように、後から追加で打ち上げた衛星でそれを捕まえに行って大気圏に落とすっていうことをやろうとしてるんですね。
あ、でもそもそもこれ以上増えないようにっていうこと。
まあ例えばですね、これからまあ、有名どころで言ったら例えばスペース X とか、あとボーイング社とか、ワンウェブ社っていう、まあ、主にこの3つとかがですね、この10年先で数千機の衛星を打ち上げたいって言ってるんですね。でそれによって地上の通信とか、まあ、そういうインフラを提供したいって言ってるんですね。で今までの60年間、スパトニックから始まったの6年間、60年間で、だいたい8000機ぐらいの人工衛星が打ち上がってるんですけど、この先の10年でその倍以上のものをガンガン打ち上げようって言ってるので、まあもう2009年にも1回衝突が起こってますから、もう次の衝突が起こるのも本当時間の問題になってしまいますよね。そうなると、その、自身が打ち上げた衛星自体が、脅かされる可能性があるんですよね。自分たちで打ち上げた衛星で自分たちの資産がそうやって破壊されてしまうと、そういったリスクを負わないためにも、自分たちが打ち上げた衛星に対してちゃんと最後まで責任を取りましょうねっていうことで、このサービスを提供しようとしていますね。
Is there any kind of international deorbiting protocol for new satellites?
Very good question, because There isn't one right now at the moment. Mm-hmm. There's only guidelines that says if you launch a satellite into space, let's bring it down, burn it up in the Earth's atmosphere in between in less than 25 years.
Mm-hmm. And does that include these other parts, you know, the fairing, for example, or there's like abandoned rocket bodies from old Russian launches, and any of those rocket bodies could just explode, right?
Yeah, unfortunately not, yeah.
Mm. Is there any discussion to put penalty or?
Yes, actually, the interesting thing about the space race, space as a, is that, you know, normally when we make rules or laws, it comes top down from the country or, and, but interesting about space is that there are, people, the companies themselves are talking about how to keep space better for themselves, keep it clean, and, you know, eventually people go there for just tours or to have fun. But, you know, with the pace that we're launching all these satellites and leaving all this junk up there, it won't be sustainable anymore. So people are starting to realize this problem. And one thing is, for example, in the World Economic Forum, the heads of countries are getting together, companies are getting together to start talking about rules that we have to implement to make sure that anything launched up there is safe.
It seems like there's a very strong argument to have some sort of regulation like that in place. I mean, from an economic standpoint, this is clearly unchecked externalities. They could build the deorbiting functionality into a satellite. Obviously, it's a lot cheaper not to do that, and then have someone else or some other generation pick up the tab instead. Why do you think this hasn't been done already?
That's a very good question, because
because the scale of the problem is already quite significant at this stage, right?
Well, people were worried about this problem, but they weren't so worried that it would happen so, like, next year, 2 years from now, or anything like that. They thought it was something more off in the far future. And up till now, it was mostly satellites by countries. So, you know, commercially, they weren't so worried about it. But now that, you know, space is becoming more and more close to our everyday lives. For example, if you pick up your smartphone and look at all the apps that you have in there, are you aware of the number of apps that use data from satellites?
Well, GPS data is probably...
Definitely, yeah.
That's a lot of them.
If you really look into it, it's like half of the apps that you have on your iPhone rely on space technology these days.
So, half of it.
Yeah. I mean, especially like maps. Right. Yeah.
We're so oblivious to this kind of stuff. Have you seen those reports where they talk about, you know, how much money the government put into NASA and then how much the technologies and stuff that came out of NASA, how much value that generated in the society? And it's like hundreds to one. It's not even close, because the stuff that they're able to figure out, you know, going to space, they like Velcro and all these weird things that we just kind of completely take for granted or have no idea about, you know, just seamlessly into your phone.
Yeah. You know? And the sad thing about it is that almost no one's aware of it.
Yeah, but it's important to the, you know, the reasoning behind why it matters too, and why it's financially viable for a country to invest in it.
Yeah, and the more and more it becomes, we develop things in space up there. It's nowadays it's becoming part of infrastructure. And the sad thing about infrastructure is that people are aware there's a problem when a problem only occurs.
Right, right.
You know, just like electricity, you know, people start complaining when we have a blackout. But they don't care about it as long as they get their lights turned on when they turn flip the switch.
確かに。
It's true.
褒めてもらえない。
そうそうそう、まさにそうなんですよね。ほんで、まあ皆さんのアプリとかも多分そうだと思うんですけど、使えないときに、あれ何これみたいな状況になりますけど、それがよりより、より現実っていうか、身近なものになってきているので、これからまさにその通信とか地球観測で、多くの衛星をどんどんどんどん打ち上げようっていう機運があるんですけど、結局それをサービスとして根付いたときに、それが急に使えなくなったときっていうのが、インフラってなってしまうと大きな問題になってくるので、そのインフラをしっかり守りましょうねっていう意味でも、自分たちが打ち上げた衛星は最後まで責任を取ってゴミにならないようにしましょうねっていう、機運が盛り上がってて、だんだんルールとして作ろうっていう向きになっていますね、世界的に。
そのなんか今すでにもうある古い、それこそバスレベルの何トンものやつとかっていうのはどうしようっていう話になってるんですか？
はい、もちろんそちらも除去していかないと、ゆくゆくは本当に大問題になりかねなくてですね、例えばよく、そういう大型な衛星とかで打ち上がっているのは静止軌道衛星、静止衛星軌道っていって、地上から3万8千キロのところなんですけど、ひまわりとか、ああいう気象衛星とかですね、あと大きい通信衛星とか、それこそ本当に数トンある衛星っていうのがいっぱい打ち上がってて、実はそこの3万、ほんで、その軌道に打ち上げるものは、結構赤道上に、飛んでるものが多くて、だから土星の輪っかみたいな状況にすでになってるんですね、はい、本当に数百キロ隣にもう一つの衛星があるっていうぐらい混んでる状況になってきて、もうだんだんスペースが足りなくなってきます、ね、running out of space それで非常に怖いことに一度故障した衛星っていうのが、私もちょっと最近まで知らなかったんですけど、基本的にその場で漂ってるだけだと思ってたんですね、でも実はもうすでに地上でそういった衛星をずっと監視しているという民間の会社があってですね、そちらのデータによると、2017年に3機その静止衛星軌道上でそういう異常が起こったんですね、衛星の、じゃあその衛星がもうガンガン回ってたり、そのなんかなんていうんですかね、もうなんせその軌道上にぐるぐるぐるぐる回ってるんですよね。だからもう本当に衝突するのは時間の問題なんですよね、そういうことを知ると故障したり運用が終了した衛星っていうのはもう速やかに除去しないと、もう大変なことが起こってしまうっていうのがもう見えてるんですよね、はい、
そっか。
You know the Chinese satellite is expected to crash I think next weekIt might take a little longer than... Within the next 2 weeks, there's a Chinese satellite. And I don't think they expect it to burn up in the atmosphere. They expect it to come through.
Well,
come through the atmosphere.
and maybe hit, some bits landing and somewhere.
Yeah, right? hit Earth. Is that a concern for... There have been these cases where...in Africa and in random places on Earth, in Australia, they find some weird thing that fell out of the sky, and it turns out it's part of a spacecraft.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is definitely a concern. And when we deorbit anything as part of our mission, we'll always make sure that it deorbits, and if it does even... if there is any residue, it'll land in the ocean. Mm-hmm. Yes. We'll definitely make sure to do that. But, unfortunately, we can't say that it's perfect. You know, we can't say it's 100% safe. But
that's worrying about... Sorry, but that's certainly more controlled than the current situation.
Yes, I would say so. Yes. Well, I'm sure they didn't expect it to be coming down that early either. So, but yes, when we have our, we call them so-called chaser satellites, that'll capture a defunct or malfunctioned satellite, we plan to capture using magnet.
Mm.
Yeah, and we'll use the thrusters from that chaser satellite to deorbit, so it'll be a controlled deorbit.
Mm.
Yeah, so we'll definitely make sure it burns up above the ocean.
How does wow. What happens to the chaser satellite in that process?
Burns up together.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Mm. We don't want that to become
yeah. junked.
I thought maybe it could send it off and go get another one. Or is it not at that stage?
It's not at that stage. Mm. That would be very interesting, yes, if we could do something like that.
Yeah,
but
just kind of push off of it so it goes and you push yourself back up. I don't know.
That would be a case that we could think of in the future. Yes. So, thank you for the idea,
though. So, now, for example, そのゴミとなってしまった衛星が例えば他の国のにぶつかって壊れた場合になんか訴訟になったりとかっていうことはないんですか？
そういう恐れは当然ありますし、うん、それに対してもやっぱり明確なルールっていうのはないので、
うん、なるほど、
はい、ちょっと非常に難しい問題ですよね。
なるほどなるほど、はい、ただでもその自分のに当たる可能性もあるからこう企業としてその問題の対策をする、まあ、経済的なモチベーションもあるっていうことですよね、
はい。まあ、それでやっぱりぶつかってしまったらその軌道上に基本的にそのゴミが散らばるのでその後、うん、自分自身でもそれ以上打ち上げにくくなってしまうし、
うん、
その結果そのゴミがやっぱり自分たちの衛星にもぶつかってでもっと壊れちゃったっていう可能性は十分あり得るので、
うん、
まあまだルールがない現在としては結局その自分たちの資産を守るっていうモチベーションは十分あると思いますね、
うんうんはい、やっぱりそういうそのアストロスケールみたいなサービスを使おうっていうところはもうだからどんどん増えると
期待していますね
そっかそっか、
はい、
宇宙ゴミね、
まあ、ただそのルールってっていう意味ではですね、
うん、
まあ、我々も主体的に参加してて、
うん、
関わっているんですけど、例えばその何か衛星をいっぱい打ち上げたいと、でそれをその許可するそういう許可制度みたいな、
うん、
もうできていいんじゃないのみたいな話があって、うん、そうなるとその例えばね、衛星が機能不全になったり運用が終了したときにちゃんと責任を持ってそれを除去しましょうねとそういう対策を施してなかったら許可は与えませんよってそういう制度ができるかもしれないですね、まあ、そうなったら、はい、弊社みたいなそのサービスを何だか利用しとかないとそもそも打ち上げれなくなっちゃうっていうこと
は、うん、アメリカなんか一応FDA じゃない、なんかありません？こう許可。I thought I've read like、
yes.
SpaceX having to apply for it.
Yes, well, actually, just about 2 weeks ago, a company launched 4 small satellites that didn't have their authorities to launch.
Whoa.
Yeah, and the bad thing about that was that these satellites were so small.
Mm-hmm.
That they aren't trackable from the ground.
Eh.
And plus, they didn't get the permission to communicate with the satellite dishes from the ground.
Okay.
So that means no communication,
eh?
No tracking. So they just launched 4 pieces of junk into space.
For what?
Beats me.
What?
You know, I read a project they're trying to send up some shiny disco ball up there or something. And this disco ball is just going to be really reflective. And the idea is that people are going to see it from Earth reflecting light.
Stop.
To Earth. But it's like, so it doesn't do anything. It's just shiny, you know, and it. I mean, I guess it's cool that people are going to see this thing moving. But we can already see, like, you know, iridium flares.
Uh-huh.
It's just people aren't doing it.
We can also see the space station, too.
Yeah. I saw, I remember I went outside with my dad once and I saw the what was it? I think it was like the last separation of a space shuttle and the and the space station ever.
Really?
Yeah. Just luck. Like, there was, I just saw them separate, and you could just see whole thing. And it was just mind-boggling. Because, I mean, people, on almost any night, you can walk outside and look up and probably find a satellite at this point.
Yeah.
Almost any time of day, you can probably, there's like a website called Heavens Above that will tell you where all the satellites, where they're passing. And
there's an app, too, no?
But
I've used it.
Yeah, it's interesting that we can see these things, but these
disco ball.
Yeah, these CubeSats. Like, what do you think about this? I mean, it's so much more affordable to launch.
Exactly.
Now the launch cost is way less.
That's right.
And they have shared payloads that can fit these really small, you know, micro CubeSats. And in some cases, they're planning to release. I think wasn't there an ISRO mission that released like 300 satellites at once or something, like last year?
Yeah, I remember seeing that article too,
Wait, so this company that launched 4 satellites for nothing, like, they go unpunished, right? Because currently there's no
Well, they paid a lot of money.
Right.
Well, I think initially they were trying to do some communication tests, but they didn't get the authorization to do that.
Okay.
So in the end, I don't know why they went and launch them, but
this is an American company.
I'm not sure about that. Okay. I don't remember that. Yeah.
Do you think that sort of thing might become more common? You know, these kind of unauthorized sneaky.
Well, hopefully no, because if they, I don't know why they risk that, but if they do, no one's gonna launch for them anymore unless they do it by themselves.
I mean,
because even the rocket that launched them, they would have a bad reputation also because they probably knew that these satellites were not authorized.
No. So.
Or it was at least their job to know, right?
Yeah, yes.
You can't just have random stuff in your spaceship,
right? Because, you might be launching a total weapon up there and I didn't know that. Really?
That's great. That's great.
Do you think that's something we need to worry about, is people launching crazy weapons up there, or... Could some satellite zapping, there must be a lot of confusion or concern about this, because a lot of things that could be put in space, you know, potentially have militaristic functionality as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, there are already rules that say that we're not allowed to launch, you know, weapons into space of mass destruction. So, but it's technologically possible already. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we already have spy sats in space that the public doesn't know what they're doing. Only the people who launched them know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so who knows what's up there already. But there's always a problem that, you know, if you do have a weapon in space and you just decide to attack another satellite, it's just going to cause more debris. More junk in space.
Yeah.
Do you want to risk yourself doing that?
That's great.
Yeah.
It's kind of a similar issue with the space station, right? You know, you can't, anything happens inside the space station, it's like, this thing is super fragile, you know, and I think the space environment seems like it's kind of the same way. You know, no one's going to be able to, you know, it's a problem that affects everyone fairly evenly, right?
Mm-hmm.
The orbital debris problem.
Yeah, I mean, because almost any company, any country in the world, they have an interest utilizing space to provide some kind of service to their people. Mm. And if, you know, it's just like the CO2 problem.
Right.
Are you going to start blaming people for it? Mm. I mean, of course, you know, to maybe some extent, you could maybe blame someone, but can you really? I mean, and it's a, you know, Earth problem.
Right.
Not just a country problem. Right. It affects everyone on the planet.
Mm. Mm.
The same situation we have right now with space. Everyone's going to use space to some extent.
Mm.
And are you going to just start blaming some people for it?
Mm.
In the end, that, you know, everyone wants to use it. So, yeah, I guess maybe everyone should take some part, pitch in to keep it space a cleaner place.
Right, right.
There's a lot of different methods that have been suggested in science fiction novels and in movies even, for removing orbital debris. And a lot of scientists have come up with different ideas that they think that will be the best. Out of all the different possible approaches, why did you guys select the approach that you're using now? And why does that one make the most sense? Because there's like the ground-based laser idea and the big kind of gel net ideas and releasing gases and different kinds of things people have considered. What do you think of all these different strategies and why is...
Well, all these strategies that's been thought up of, it's still all in theory. In theory, and none of them has been tested yet. And the only test that was ever occurred close to a test would be using a robot arm. But first of all, the satellite that had the robot arm was huge, very huge compared to what it captured, and it was in close proximity to begin with. So it was just a test of the robot arm itself. And what we're trying to do is, you know, for example, you have a satellite that's like maybe 200 kilos. Do you want to launch a huge bus to capture a 200 kilo satellite? That's not very smart, is it? And it'll probably cost like 10, 20 times more to launch a satellite to capture a much, much smaller one. Not very smart. And yes, just like you mentioned, there are other technologies that's been thought up of, like big fishnets or even a harpoon. But there are lots of technological difficulties to actually realize these methods of capturing another satellite. And yes, with all the testing and not testing, but well, everything on paper, but we thought that using the magnet and capturing the satellite is the most economical and realistic way to capture another satellite and bring it down.
How large is the actual device that you guys are developing or have developed?
Well, right now we're developing a satellite we call ELSA-D. End of life service by Astroscale and -D for demonstration mission, because actually capturing another satellite has never been tested in space before.
It sounds extremely difficult.
It is just the actually, you know, everybody constantly gets focused on the capturing part, but actually getting in a line with the other satellite—that's the most difficult part, because. Like I mentioned before, a defunct satellite, you can't tell how it's going to, you can't tell its motions when that happens, because what we can see from the ground is the orbit that it's doing, but we can't actually see how it's moving in that orbit. It could be like rotating like crazy, spinning like crazy. Yeah, that we can't see from the ground. So we have to be able to, you know, get close enough to that satellite that we're capturing and analyze data to see the actual motion. And before we capture that defunct satellite, we have to be perfectly aligned with that satellite we're trying to capture, or it'll just cause another collision and more junk. Exactly what we don't want to do.
How do you deal with a satellite that's spinning so rapidly?
Well, the only thing that we can do is get in perfect alignment with that satellite, so it's spinning at the same rate, rotating at the same rate, so that relatively they look like they're relatively they're still, you know, in motion to each other. Then so we can finally you know, get in contact.
A docking procedure almost, but the,
exactly.
But the magnet makes it not have to be as precise.
Yes. Okay. That's
Wait, so at one point, can you tell how the object is moving? I mean, the debris is moving.
Well, it'll all depend on how large that debris is and how close we can get to it before we actually dock it and capture it.
Right.
So to get to, I'm just trying to figure that, think this through. To get next to the piece of debris, you have to have an orbital insertion that is already optimized to get you into the orbit of the debris, right?
So yes, to begin with.
It's quite a specific requirement of the rocket and the mm-hmm. launch itself.
Yes, but all launchers are like that. So mm-hmm. they want their satellite to be in a certain orbit and inclination. Yeah.
But usually, it's a lot less specific than we need to be next to this piece of junk. That's flying around like this,
right? Mm-hmm.
それはあんまりいいものを積んでしまうと重くなるし効果になりますから、そこはその授業として、ちゃんと儲けが出るようにやらないといけないので、そういう制限はありますけど、ちょっと一概には言えないところありますね。ただ最後に実際に捕まえるまでには全く同じ動きをしないと、本当にぶつかってしまうので、そうならないためには全く同じ動きして、互いに静止しているように見える状態になって、
That sounds like a sci-fi movie.
You're living in the 21st century. Whoa!
Wow, that sounds crazy.
That is, it's great that the debris will be removed, but as a technological feat, mm-hmm. I think that would be very impressive, to be able to do it.
Yes, and it's a big impact to the market too because it's never happened before.
Mm. What is your timeline?
We are going to launch this demonstration mission within next year.
Oh wow.
Yes.
Within next year.
Uh-huh. So by 2020 we'll already have a service, if all goes well, that we can provide to our customers, telling them that we have succeeded. It's doable. It's economic.
Right.
And it's the only thing that's available in the market.
Mm. Wow, that's so cool.
Sounds like a good position to be in.
Yeah, for sure, right?
What about collecting more information on the debris that is out there? As you said, that there's this much smaller debris that we cannot detect. Can't we place detectors in orbit that could monitor this debris?
Actually, that's a very excellent question. Actually, we've tried to do that already, our company. And last November, we launched a satellite in order to do that, to get information about debris in situ. Yes.
About the because much smaller
debris. Much smaller ones, yes. Oh. Because we can't see that from the ground, and no one knows for sure how much there is up there. And we did launch a satellite on November 28th from our Vostochny, a spaceport in Russia. But unfortunately, there was a failure with the last stage of the rocket, and that satellite and all the other satellites never reached their orbit. Fortunately, they didn't stay up in space to become space debris.
Thank God.
Thank God.
You narrowly avoided that irony.
Yes.
Are you going to try that again, or...?
Well, we have initially thought of launching another satellite, but in the end, we decided that we'll concentrate all our resources on our next mission,
which is
the ELSA-D mission that we'll launch next year.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Well, that's too bad because it would have been very cool, if that was up there telling us about the smaller debris.
Yes, it would have been the first actual data that we have about any small debris in the actual space up there. And we might have been able to do some interesting things with that. But
is it a possibility to track all the small pieces of debris, or is it more about mapping a debris distribution or something?
Well, being able to observe all those small specks in space would not be realistic. I don't know, maybe 10 to 20 years in the future, it might be possible. But in order to keep dodging them, it would be another difficulty. I mean, do you really want to spend propellant to do that? Because in order to dodge a bullet, you know, you have to move away from it. And once you launch a satellite up in space, you're very limited to the propellant that you have. And you want to be able to use that for the initial purposes that the satellite was launched there for in the first place, not just dodging bullets.
So the satellite that, if it had been successful, you guys would have put up there, it would have kind of created a probability distribution of smaller debris, or how would it have? I understand this might be a painful subject because it can't happen now. But I just want to know about what you guys were thinking about doing there.
Well, the satellite itself, it had it was four-sided, like a square, like a cube, elongated cube, and two sides of it had this very thin layer, and it had lots of electrical lines in it running through it, so we would know that something went through that layer. That would be the debris. We would know the motion of the satellite, so we would be able to tell in which direction it came through, the size of it, the speed of it too, and from that we would be able to sort of get an idea of the distribution of debris in that area.
でもなんかみんながこう自由にこうさっきの会社もそうだけど勝手に打ち上げたりとかしてる中で、御社だけこうすごいプレッシャーというか、こう失敗した時に絶対に宇宙ゴミにだけはなってはいけないというか、そのなんか皮肉を避けなきゃいけないから大変ですよね。
そうですね。はい。我々が打ち上げた衛星が結局また機能不全になって宇宙ゴミになったっていうことはもう何としてでも避けないといけないので、そうですよね。まあそういうこともあってですね、よく聞かれるのがそのどう対処するのと、基本的には、その使えない衛星ができた後に打ち上げる、一緒に打ち上げてしまうと、ね、時間が経てば経つほど故障する可能性が高くなるので、その軌道上にある時間をできるだけ短くして、そういうことを避けようというふうに考えておりますね。
これいつできた会社なんでしたっけ？
2013年の5月に、はい、できた会社で、シンガポールに本社があるんですけど、それで、最初はその岡田が一人でずっとやってたんですけど、2015年に日本に、日本支社を設立して、そこが、基本的に工場として動いてて、それで昨年の2017年の2月に UK にもオフィスを新しく開きました。
じゃあその工場として稼働しているのは日本なんですね。
そうですね。主にその衛星を作るっていう拠点としては日本になっておりまして、UK の方は一度打ち上げた衛星との通信するための管制局ですね。そちらを今イギリス政府からもいろいろ援助をいただいて、そういった地上局を今作っているところですね。
へえ、
What are your thoughts on I wanted to ask about Whipple shields.Whipple shields, you know, they have these advanced, they keep innovating stronger and stronger Whipple shields. Remember there was that incident where a piece of debris had struck the windshield of one of the space shuttles?
Yes, sir.
And created quite a scary looking impact on the windshield. And they started developing these crazy Whipple shields, which are these...It's like designed to stop orbital debris and cause it to break into more. So a single piece of debris would hit the shield, break into, 100 pieces. Then all 100 pieces would hit the next level of the shield and then break into smaller pieces and hit the next level of the shield. And hopefully it doesn't, go all the way, way through. But what do you think about that strategy and whether it's sustainable long term or...
うん、
because clearly all these companies must be spending a lot of money to develop the plating, and obviously it's very heavy, the Whipple shielding, you know, so the it seems right there, just not having to put the Whipple shields on would just be a huge financial benefit to everyone in space.
Well, assuming that this Whipple shield does work as it's designed, I think that would be worth paying for. But the thing about space, the difficulties about space, is that one thing is that we can't have that same environment on the ground.
Mm.
So it's hard to really test what would happen.
Mm.
And we still have that difficulty even in the ISS when they design these equipment to be used there. But because they weren't able to imitate the same exact environment, well, specifically speaking, zero-G, it didn't work as it was designed, or it was the astronauts had much more difficulty putting the things together because it wasn't in 1G environment.
それ結構今でもあることなんですか？
起こっています。はい。
あ、そうなん
だ。だからその無重力っていうのは本当に分かっててもやっぱりその同じ環境を再現できないっていうのは宇宙に行って初めて
分かること
っていうのは結構あるので本当にデザインされた通りに物が動くかどうかっていうのも保証はないのでこれが確実にできるっていうのはなかなかやっぱ難しいところありますね。だからそのシールドも本当に、できてそれがその機能通りのことを起こるかどうかっていうのは、まあ、もちろんできたら一番ハッピーですけど、結局最初にその粉々に砕くということなので下手したらゴミが数は増えるかもしれないですね。
Do you think you guys are going to solve this? Are humans going to solve the space debris?
Well, of course. Of course. We're the first spark to tackle this problem. But in the end, it's not something that we alone can do because the problem is so big and there's just so much out there. And once we have our demonstration mission and it succeeds, people will think, okay, we can do it too. And, you know, as rules and regulations go, not every country will be willing to use our technology. I'm sure there'll be countries that will want to do it themselves because they don't want a different country, you know, connecting with their own because who knows what could happen on there. We might be, you know, technologically speaking, we might be able to suck out some information from that satellite and use it for, I don't know, some reasons. Yeah.
Are there other potential applications like that? Or maybe other applications that you guys are considering? You know, this ability, if you guys can figure this out, to have this meet the rotation of the debris, for example, could facilitate some very interesting things. Repairs, for example, you know, let's say they launch the James Webb and something's wrong, an arm stuck or something, and we need something to go up there and meet it in that orbit and perform a very small task. And let's say it's rotating, and so it's a very similar, I mean, not, it doesn't seem like a whole lot of modification is required to the functionality you guys are developing to go and do a lot of other cool things.
Yeah, very good point, because there are about three companies already putting that thought to realizing it. And it's currently called in-orbit servicing. And they're thinking about building satellites to refuel and repair satellites are already up there. But that will be primarily focused only on the huge satellites that are sent up to geostationary orbit because, you know, in order to launch a satellite like that to service, it'll cost a considerable amount of money. So if you're willing to spend that much money, you're going to have more benefit out of extending the lifetime of a satellite.
Maybe with economies of scale, you know, you can be repairing and refueling a bunch of different satellites.
それはそれで宇宙ゴミが減る結果になるってことですね。
ただ結局弊社も最初は実は複数の衛星を捕まえるっていうことを考えてたんですけど、結局その、そうするとそれだけ推進剤も必要になりますし、やっぱり技術的にもどんどん難しくなりますし、いっぱい今宇宙空間にゴミがあると言っても、普通的に絶対的な位置からしたらかなり離れてますから、やっぱりその一気にいろいろ集めるっていうのは、それはそれで多分コスト的に見合わないところがあるので、現在ではその一つ落とすのに一つ打ち上げる、1対1でやるっていうことを考えております。
Could there be some very unique circumstances where it would make sense? You know, you could grab one satellite and wait a year or something and maybe some trajectory would just happen to come. You know, is there, if you expand the time horizon, is there maybe some pretty fancy stuff?
But the point was that you don't want yours to stay there for too long, right? Because then there'll be, it could cause trouble.
Yeah, there is a higher possibility of malfunctioning. The satellite we sent up might be malfunctioning. So, yes, in the sense of staying there and waiting for another one to come closer, it might not be too reasonable. Unless it's coming like tomorrow or a week later or something. But in order to capture more satellites and bring them down together would mean that you have to have a bigger satellite with more propellant and more features. So it comes to the point if it's economical enough to do that. And maybe 10 to 20 years later, it will be. But in terms of 2020, when we're really starting to try to provide our service, it doesn't seem to be realistic.
This is far out stuff.
Yeah, it's happening up in space where we can't actually see it.
Yeah.
That's another problem. You know, we tell people there's lots of junk up there, but oh, really? Most people would say, who cares?
Well, we have, with the rise of flat earthers, you know, conversations like this become even more obscure. You know, like people are, it's surprising to me how out of touch most people are with, you know, space and what's going on. And especially when you think about potentially how large a role and how big an influence space will be on everyone's life and on society in general in just the near future. Most people I talk to, they don't know, they couldn't name the planets of our solar system, right? Like that's probably standard.
When I was even studying as a PhD student, I would have opportunities to go outside and speak to the public. But almost every time I discovered that the basic understanding about space in the public is almost zero. And, you know, people hear about NASA, space shuttles, and astronauts. But they just, it's all that they hear from the news and all that they get from the media. So they never, you know, really try to research more deeper into it or discover the realities or anything like that. And so the difficulties that I experienced working in space is that you have to have the public stand on the same level on understanding first. That's where we have to begin with. And then to have them understand about space junk, that's going to make it more difficult. But if you bring it down to the point that it affects their daily lives, then they get concerned. So it's just a way of bringing the message to them, how to convey that message so that they can feel that it's something that'll really affect their lives immediately.
Yeah, I have my own environment project, and this is an environment issue on Earth. But, you know, people still don't really connect with it. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't really understand it. So like, なんか宇宙ってなるとさらにハードルが あるだろうなっていうのは想像しやすいです
ね。やっぱりその時間軸で考えると、
うん、
自分が生きてる間に本当に問題になるかどうかっていうのは、そこはちょっとはっきりしないところもありますから、そういう考え方をされてしまうと、
うん、
確かにそういう人にとってはもうどうでもいい問題なんですよね、うん、私がどうせ生きてる間もう関係ないからみたいな言われてしまうと、
うん
うん、まあそういう人を説得するのはちょっとまあ他より難しいかもしれないですけど、やっぱ将来的に決してそうではないと、
うん、
あなたがその生きてる間でも十分問題になるし、今、まあ、宇宙に関しては本当にその衛星を打ち上げるのもロケットの価格も安くなっているので、
うん、
まあ、それがあるからこそいろんな会社がそのもう何百も何千機も打ち上げて、それを使ったサービスを提供するっていうのが出てきますので、それが本当に携帯電話の通信 6G か 7G か分からないですけど、それがもう全部もう衛星でやってますってなった時にですね、
うん、
その衛星が故障してもう電話できないってなったら、もうわんさかわんさか文句言う人は当然出てきますから、
うん、
そういうことが起こらないためにも、まあ、弊社がちょっと頑張ってますよっていうのがあるので、まあそういう伝え方ができるともう少し、うん、身近な問題として捉えていただける方もいらっしゃるのではないかと思いますね。
It's hard to express how cool what you guys are doing is. I just think about you know, the idea of a private company going out there and trying to confront this orbital debris problem is like, it's so science fiction. I mean, even to yourself, you must realize that this is like, if you had read a story about a company like this when you were a kid, you'd be like, whoa, that's so, like, they really thought this through. Mm. It's like, mm-hmm. you know, like, it's so cool. Like,
just the right? fact that private companies are doing something with, like, space industry alone. I mean, when I was a child, for example, like, that wasn't something that was, you know,
mm-hmm.
common. Now mm. it's like, oh, yeah, like, there's SpaceX and there's, like, you know, Richard Branson and all kinds of stuff. But, yeah, so, like, 宇宙ゴミを民間企業片付けるってすごいことですよね、本当に。
はい。私もね、前職も JAXA で働いたりしてたんですけど、うん、やっぱり普段の業務に追われてるとですね、あんまりそういう意識しないんですけど、やっぱりふと、立ち直ったり、我に返るとですね、すごいことやってるな、みたいな。ほんで、まあ当然ね、外の方から見ても、何言ってんのレベルのことやってますから、でもやっぱそうやってですね、宇宙のすごい面白いところはやっぱり今でもその夢がある世界ですし、
うん、
何らかの憧れみたいなものがあるので、それだけでもすごいねって言ってくださる人もいれば、いやそこまで お金かけてなんかそんなことして本当に意味があるのと、まあ、幸い意味があるからこそ、その、会社としてできるわけですね。
そりゃそうですよね。は
い。みんな、食っていかないと死んじゃうんで。はい。そういうことができる時代になってきたっていうのは、非常にまあ、宇宙をずっと好きで育ってきた人間としては、もう、嬉しくて楽しくてしゃあないですね。決してその、宇宙で仕事するっていう選択肢が、JAXA や NASA だけじゃないっていうのが、で、将来的に子供たちがその大人になったら宇宙飛行士だって宇宙に行くっていうことも決して JAXA や NASA だけじゃなくて普通の仕事の一つの選択肢として宇宙で仕事する、
うん、
宇宙に実際に行って仕事するっていうことが出てくる時代になると思うんで、本当に羨ましいですね。
And their safety, you know, their ability to do that will partly be because ofcompanies like your own and people like yourself that are involved in facilitating that, you know, so there are a lot of dreams kind of resting on the success of this idea and this enterprise, I think. So,
mm-hmm. And even space tourism, if you're going to mm-hmm. send people out there, it has to be perfectly safe mm-hmm. and perfect, because you just can't have, you can't risk having an accident.
No.
Because even the smallest accident to lead to the deaths of all the people that were on there. And once that happens, mm-hmm. it's not going to fly for another few years. And mm-hmm. people are going to be scared, seriously scared about riding such a vehicle
mm-hmm.
that might get you killed. I mean, I'm sure it was the same case as airplanes. And, right. You know, we still have incidents from time to time. But the space, in the case of space, it'll be more difficult because to begin with, people will probably be paying much, much more money to go there.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. And the smallest incident will lead to the deaths of everyone mm. on there.
Right.
And, yeah, so the difficult thing about having people in space is the safety problem.
Mm. Yes. Mm.
And hopefully we can contribute to that.
That's exciting.
I think it's a, yeah, it's a great
I think, mission. Hakamada-san かなが言ってたけど、その、まあ、もちろんこういうビジネスに関わるって言った時に、まあ、エンジニアとか、まあ、理系じゃないといけないとか、でもこう今民間企業ってたくさんあるから、例えば そういう企業に行けばマーケティングの人がいて、事務の人がいて、総務の人がいてとか、こう別にこう理系だったり PhD 持ってるとかじゃなくても関わろうと思えば、その仕事があるっていうのも夢があるねっていう話を。
そうなんですよね。
ね、
あの、まあ、それはジャックさんもそうですけど、やっぱ事務をやってる方がいらっしゃいますし、あの決してその理系のバックグラウンドを持った人ばかりではないですし、まあ、当然ながらあの袴田さんの iSpace とか弊社のアストロスケールも、うん、あの当然その事務をやってるか、いらっしゃる方がいらっしゃるんですけど、うん、やっぱりその我々みたいな会社の強みっていうのは、そういうことに関わることによって、なんかそういう夢のある話に直接関わってると。
うん、
それで、あの、まあ、あの、11月に打ち上げた、あの、イデアっていう、その、ゴミの現場で観測する衛星を打ち上げた時もですね、社員全員がもう盛り上がってて、
うん、
今からこいつが宇宙に行くんだっていう、すごい熱い気持ちを共有してたわけですね。
うん、
それはもうエンジニアだろうが事務の方だろうが関係なく全員で、うん、あのその会社を回すことができて、その結果としてこういう衛星が打ち上がるっていう熱い気持ちはシェアできるので、だからあのこれからですね、その宇宙に関わりたいっていう方がいらっしゃったら、まあ必ずしも理系じゃないといけないっていうことはなくて、本当にどんな方でも、まあ、将来的には本当に芸術家でもやっぱりそういう、うん、人がその宇宙で生活することになってくると、ね、実験だけやったらいいっていうわけじゃなくなってくると思いますので、
確かに、
やっぱりあの人間にはそういったあのエンターテインメントもないと、ちょっと精神的なバランスは取れないところあると思いますので、そうなるとその宇宙だからこそできる絵とか音楽とかっていう産業も生まれてきたら、もうどんな人でも宇宙で活躍できる場があるっていう時代が来ると思いますので、そういう時代に生まれてきてる子供たちは羨ましいです、ね。
Us too, yeah. Like me too, yeah, yeah. I feel that way.
Yeah, I think Elon Musk was saying, なんかそのコメディ要素が重要になるだろうみたいな、やっぱり暮らしていく上で楽しくないといけないから。そうすると、だから本当お笑い芸人とかもそうですけど、こう今まででは想像できないようなこう、なんか必要な職業とかが出てきたりとか、楽しみですよね。
It certainly feels like if you're a young person, relatively young person now, you could kind of meet the future halfway. Like there's things you could do now so that you'll be ready when, you know, the opportunities in space really expand, you know, in 10 years, in 15 years. Whoever's prepared for that is probably going to become an astronaut or, you know, have some role in space. And if you've spent 15 years thinking about it, by that time, I mean, you're probably the guy, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the way, you know, technology and science is developing these days, you know, 10 years ago, I'm sure people didn't imagine the iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
That almost everyone would have a right. smartphone. So the time span that things are developing and new technology is evolving is so short these days that by the time that our kids are working in the industries, they'll have so many things that that doesn't even exist today.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, it's very exciting. I mean, the sky is not the limit. There is no limit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They could do anything they imagine, but you have to be ready for it.
Mm.
So, you know, studying science, having the basics to understand science, I think would be more important, more and more important as our kids grow up, because when they start studying in universities, by the time they're studying in universities, they'll be studying on subjects or sciences that didn't exist in our time.
Mm. Mm.
So if you want to be prepared for that, you have to be prepared for anything to come.
Right, right.
Yeah, it is changing so fast, and I feel like it's changing faster every day. And do you have any intuitions about this, and how, what are your kind of philosophical thoughts on our species after, you know, billions of years of evolution on this planet, that life is actually leaving the surface of this planet, you know, and trying to live elsewhere for the first time? And you have this unbelievably lucky circumstance where you're actually involved in this process. But what do you think about, like, what's happening to the species? You know, like, we've developed so rapidly, just really, I mean, the Wright brothers was like 100 years ago, you know.
Yeah, just 100 years
like,
ago.
Like, that's crazy. It's crazy. 100 years ago, the Wright brothers. What happened? You know, what is this? This is some kind of metamorphosis, transformation. It's the next frontier, clearly, of exploration. But for our species, like, what is this? It's hard for me to kind of figure out what it all really means. You know, how big a deal is your, what are you doing right now involved in space and the debris? Like, from a, it's so profound, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Like, it's happening right now. Like, this departure from the planet. Who is it that said, the earth is the cradle of humanity, but humanity cannot remain in the cradle forever, right? So this was inevitable.
Yeah, and well, that's another thing that I really like about space, is because the more people go up there, and more it becomes natural to go out to space, it just, I think it's just expanding our possibilities, because we'll be expected to have more technology, more of everything that we never had until the past. And one thing that I personally want to go to space for is, I want to say the same words as Gagarin did. The earth was blue. I want to see the whole earth as a whole.
Mm. Right.
And say it from deep down my heart that the earth was beautiful. But I also want to go further into space and see, you know, the earth rise from the moon.
Right.
And even go further ahead to see the earth as just a speck. And by that time, I think we'll be farther, going farther enough that the concept of, the scale of that, the scale of things that you think of, is not just restricted to the planet.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Like, if you have people going normally to the moon, you'll think about yourself going there, or maybe you'll have a relative or a friend there, and it becomes like something very normal in your everyday life.
Mm. Yeah.
Then it just expands your imagination or the way that you think.
Mm.
And once people go out to space and see Earth as a whole, you realize that there are really no borders.
Mm.
And that you could finally see that we're just a species on this planet, not Japanese, Russians, Americans, we're Earthlings.
Right.
Yeah. And one day when we meet aliens, I think that'll really come to a reality because we'll see them as just aliens from another planet. They'll see us the same way, not Japanese, Russians, Americans, things like that. So, you know, being able to finally free ourselves from the Earth's gravity will just really expand our possibilities. And through those possibilities, more jobs, of course, more just simple possibilities. And I would really like to live long enough to experience what the world has, the human race has to bring. Hopefully not destruction and killing ourselves.
Right.
But, you know, people always, there's always two kind of people thinking optimistically and pessimistically. But because we have both sides, we could see that the bad side of the future, what it could bring to us. Because there was always the people who say that technology will only lead to our destruction. But because we have people telling us that this might be a possibility, there's also the other side that's saying that, well, we'll learn from our mistakes before we destroy each other, hopefully destroying everyone, and that we could, you know, think ahead to make sure that this doesn't happen. And thank God this is happening and we're still here.
Yeah.
We, even with all these nuclear missiles and things, we're managing to control this and hopefully never to use them, even if we're making all this stuff. And hopefully this philosophy will live on even if we go to space, and that the human race will try to at least thrive on to go further ahead without destroying each other.
I like this idea of kind of freeing up the human mind to think about things differently in space. And I don't know if you know this, but the first photograph taken of Earth was on the first Apollo mission. That photograph was the inspiration for the environmental movement. And there was no environmental movement before that photograph. And it's just a picture that someone took with a pretty regular camera, you know, out the window of that spacecraft. And just the image of the Earth was enough to create one of the most significant psychological changes in humans that we've seen, where environmentalism, I mean, people generally now, I mean, we care, you know, and there was hardly a concept of it before that photograph. And I don't know if you've seen the pale blue dot thing from Carl Sagan. It's one of my favorites. But yeah, the pale blue dot suspended in a sunbeam is the reality. And the loneliness of space, I think, can remind us that all we have is each other, you know? And we kind of forget that reality, I think.
And I remember the mindset that I had when I came back from the States, living back in Japan. That was the first time I realized that I'm not Japanese. I mean, in a very philosophical way. Yes, physically I'm purely 100% Japanese, but the way I think, the way I act, I'm perfectly not Japanese. But I was only able to realize that when I came back to Japan and saw myself trying to blend in with everyone else, but not succeeding.
You probably had all these Americans telling you how Japanese you were up until that point.
Right.
But I was lucky enough to realize that because I had experience living abroad and coming back. And that helped me to understand that you're only able to really get a good feeling about who you are, what you are, only once you leave and go into a different environment.
Yeah.
And I think that that feeling that we might get when we reach space and realize that and see how earthly we are, or whatever you like to say, that would just like open up a whole new door of recognition, possibilities that would, and especially appreciate how beautiful and how fragile our planet is.
Yeah.
Because when I started studying astronomy, one of my strongest interests was finding the second Earth.
Oh.
Finding another Earth on another solar system or whatever. But in order to do that, I had to study what the Earth is, right, how the Earth is, and in order to find something similar to that. But the more and more we study, I study these things, I just realize how difficult it is to actually have an environment just like the Earth, to harbor life, have water. And it was very weird because as an astronomer, I truly believe that there are other life forms in the universe. But seeing how hard it is to find another Earth, it made me think that, wait a second, maybe we are only the only life form in this universe because it's just so perfectly made. But that's from a human standpoint, of course. I mean, Earth life form standpoint.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, it's kind of this notion that you're actually part of your environment, you know, and you don't really realize it until you kind of contextualize it that way, you know, like could you live on another planet? Could you go to Mars or something? You can, but it's always this, you recognize how perfect Earth is and how, you know, how amazing it is that you know, just go to Starbucks or, I don't know, people just walk around. Like, it's so comfortable, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
But the air, you know, the sun, all these things that we love so much and are so compatible to ourselves, you know, you look at space and you realize you can't quite take this for granted. There's very few environments that have any of this, you know?
Couldn't agree more.
Was there anything that you wanted to advertise to people, to our listeners, or like, nanka koyu
Elsa D
koyu nanka saito arimasu toka ibento arimasu toka nanka kokuchi shitai koto tte arimasu?
Well, mochiron mazu wa Astro Scale という会社があるっていうことですし、あの宇宙ゴミっていう、あのなんか他の惑星にあるような話っぽいけど実は非常に身近な問題があるっていうことを、皆さんにお伝えできればそれがまず一番ですね、はい、
アストロスケールみんな 今すぐググってググってください
It's so inspiring what you're doing and your company andI mean, like we were talking about earlier, the fact that it's not JAXA and it's not NASA, but it's a group of people who decided to just make a company and go for it. I find that really inspirational. Like, there's no reason why I couldn't do that. I mean, I'm not going to, probably. But it's that inspirational and cool. So I really appreciate you coming here. Like, no one else could talk to us about all this stuff, you know. You're one of the only guys that's involved in this space junk thing. So.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's always a very good opportunity for us to be able to reach out to people who normally we wouldn't have any contact to. And I really appreciate this opportunity. Thank you very much for having me today.
Thank you for coming. Thank you so much. All right. ありがとうございます。
こちらこそありがとうございました。
また遊びに来てください。
ぜひぜひよろしくお願いします。
OK. Bye.
Bye.
Bye bye.